Hello and welcome to Object Matters. My name's Craig Barker and I'm the Head of Public Engagement at the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. Object Matters is a podcast that explores the relationship between a guest and a museum collection item or a series of items. For this particular episode, I'm thrilled to be joined by my colleague on the team of the Chow Chak Wing Museum, Dr. Anthony Gill. Tony is curator of natural history and works with the Maclay Collections. Tony, lovely to have you with us. Thank you very much for coming on Object Matters.
Thank you.
Now, could you begin, before we actually talk about the object that you've selected, could you begin by talking a bit about your background and about your own research interests?
I'm a fish taxonomist. I look at study fishes and try to understand the limits of the various species. So I describe new species, revise species, and I also classify them. That also leads to an understanding of the distribution of fish species, in particular throughout the Indo-Pacific. Most of my research is on coral reef fishes and deep reef fishes. I did my PhD at the Australian Museum through the University of New England. That was followed by 20 years abroad, initially as a postdoc in the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., followed by a year at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, 10 years as shallow marine fish researcher at the Natural History Museum in London, and finally, before coming here, curator of the zoological research collections in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University in Phoenix.
So museum collections and natural history collections within museums have always been an important part of your overall research interest then anyway.
Yeah, and I started initially as a first-year student, as an intern at the Australian Museum in 1981, so a little over 40 years.
So why fish? Why did you become interested in fish in the first place?
My dad was a keen fisherman, and I started fishing with him when I was about three or four.
Yeah.
And I started keeping fish when I was five. So I've always had fish somewhere in my home. I initially was interested in freshwater fishes, and I would research where the fish came from, and I would try to replicate little communities of fish from a given habitat and given plant species that occur with them and whatever.
Yeah.
And later, when I was 14, I joined a marine aquarium club based in Newcastle, and that involved actually going out and collecting fish. So that led to an understanding of how little we know. A lot of the fishes we were collecting were juveniles and difficult to identify. That's still an interest of mine.
So is that curiosity of also then, you know, what you could see?
Yeah, and just trying to understand what's known. I mean, a lot of the, even as a high school student, I was finding fish in the river that I didn't know, you know, couldn't identify. So early on, I was sending specimens to the Australian Museum.
You were one of those students.
Yeah, one of those annoying ones. It was kind of funny because to send them, you had to preserve them in formalin. And the mayor of my town, Musselbrook, was actually a pharmacist, and he would give me little bits of formalin so I could preserve my fish.
So, look, I mean, before we dive a little deeper, more broadly, as the curator of the natural history collections, because I suspect that many of our listeners are aware that the Chow Chak Wing Museum has significant holdings of natural history, but perhaps are not necessarily aware of the breadth and scale of it. What are you in charge of in its entirety, and then what percentage of that is fish in terms of your own research interests?
Actually, a fairly small part of the natural history collections are fishes, but they're a significant part historically. The collections have their beginnings in the 18th century by Alexander Maclay. He came out in 1826 as Colonial Secretary of New South Wales, bringing with him his private collections of insects. And they included lots of extremely important specimens, specimens that species descriptions are based on, called type specimens, and lots of rare material. It wasn't till 1874 that his nephew, who took over the collections, initially they were taken over by Alexander's son, William Sharp Maclay, then after he died, William John Maclay. William John decided to expand the collections and made a concerted effort to actually embrace all of the zoological areas.
Yep.
So that's what the natural history collection mostly is that those historic collections made from 1874 to around the end of the 1880s, and it's that historic importance that makes them so significant.
Mm. Yeah. I want to come back and talk to you about that particular point, but I wonder if you could take our listeners through what your role actually involves, you know, curating such a large collection and such a diverse collection as well. You know, how do you work with the collections?
Well, as someone that's worked around museums, I have a fairly broad understanding of curatorial practice, how to look after the specimens best. Mm. And a large part of taxonomic work is about understanding the history of specimens. Unfortunately, with any older collection, and particularly ones that have been kind of squirreled away in universities, there's a tendency for data to be lost.
Yes.
So you may have a specimen with no information at all on it. And so a lot of my work is actually trying to understand the history of the specimens, going back through diaries, publications, and so on, to understand the historical significance of those specimens.
And that includes things like provenance and...
Yeah. And sometimes there are things that, you know, you don't expect to find in the collection, but in the 19th century, there was much more exchange, an undocumented exchange between museums. And so you'd find things that were published on by someone external to the university or to the collection.
Yeah.
But somehow we've ended up with the material.
Yeah.
So there's often quite a lot of work just trying to make sense of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, given our particular collection is historic, as you say, from the 19th century and predominantly from the later decades, and that most natural history museums around the world, when we think of places, you know, you mentioned a few that you've worked at as well, the Natural History Museum in London and Smithsonian and the Australian Museum here in Sydney, that are often rooted on rather historic collections. What's beyond that historical curiosity and the intrinsic interest? What's the relevance of understanding that data collected 150, 200, 250 years ago for 21st century understanding of science and nature and biodiversity?
Well, there's one connection concerns the actual names of the species. So particularly with type specimens, they're the ones that the original descriptions of new species were based on.
Yeah.
The descriptions are often, or usually, inadequate for actually determining which species was actually being named.
Yeah.
So that's the specimens, the type specimens that you need to study in order to properly associate the names. Well, that's one thing. That's nomenclature.
Yep.
More significant today, though, is trying to understand past distributions, particularly now as we're looking at things like expanding distributions into more temperate areas from tropical areas, that kind of thing, and loss of species due to habitat loss. Those are both two big issues.
Yeah.
And our collections can speak directly to those issues.
Have we got material in the Chow Chak Wing collection in the places where you've been over the years conducting your own work? You talked about primarily coral reefs, and I know you've done a lot of work in Australian reefs, but you know, do we have material in the collection that are from the same areas where you yourself have done more recent work?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my work is actually collection-based, so it's not necessarily me going out in the field, but studying collections from around the world. Regardless of how small a collection is, any collection contributes to a global understanding.
Yeah.
And museum specimens are treated more or less like library books.
Yeah.
You borrow them.
Yeah.
Our experts borrow them and study them all together so they can understand species distributions and so on.
Yeah.
So a lot of the specimens in the Chow Chak Wing Museum fish collection are actually highly significant to my research. They were some of the earliest expeditions to southern New Guinea, a lot of northern Australian collections, both coasts of Australia, there's some Fijian collections. Mm. They all contribute to our understanding. Yeah, so they are all things that I study and incorporate with material from all around the world.
Yeah. I mean, it's also interesting, you've hit upon something that many of our colleagues at the museums do, and indeed in other cultural institutions, is that outside of our curatorial or museum-based roles, we're engaged in academic research and working with other collections or working in the field. How do you balance that?
Well, it's a struggle because you know, it's not seen as a core activity, and so a lot of it is actually done in my free time.
Yeah, because you publish prolifically in your field.
Well, try to.
Try to.
So, yeah, there's, you know, I spend a lot of annual leave and weekends working on and after hours working on projects. And often they're collaborative projects, so you're driven also by collaborators wanting to push things forward, that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's not always controlled. It can be a little chaotic.
The results are certainly superb. Before we go on and talk more specifically about one particular item from the collection, I do want to just speak to you briefly about two of the exhibitions that you've been involved in. I know you've been involved in quite a few of the exhibitions, but two that are currently visible. One is an exhibition called Natural Selections, which was part of our opening suite of exhibitions. The other one, which we're going to talk about a bit in this episode, opening in August 2022, an exhibition called Australian Seashore. Could you just explain to our listeners a little bit about both of the exhibitions?
Well, Natural Selections was an opportunity to talk about the natural history collections and their significance. It was also a way of continuing what we provided in the Maclay exhibition space, which had a certain feel to it. So you will notice that feel when you...
Particularly with those historic cabinets that were, you know, an integral part of the original Maclay Museum.
Yeah. So we divided, I work with senior curator of the Maclay Collections, Jude Philp, on that exhibition, and we divided the exhibition into several components which occupy different areas. One was, is it real? Which speaks to, well, it's the main question you get from the audience.
From the visitors,
is that a real object?
Yeah.
And it's an opportunity also to talk about how collections were developed from initial things called cabinets of curiosities through and how they challenged current thought about the natural world.
Because it's also an interesting thing that, and I'm not meaning in any way, shape or form to demean our fantastic exhibitions team and our curators in respective fields, but from a public perspective, an art exhibition is, you know, paintings hanging on the wall makes sense. And, you know, for my field, archaeology, shelves and shelves of objects that are somehow related to one another. But the actual physical display of natural history, where you've got, you know, as large specimens like an adult red kangaroo, and then not too far away, a whole set of small insects. I mean, there's a really remarkable scale. What are some of the challenges that...
Well, I was saying about the areas that we try to cover. You have to then tailor the specimen choice to fit those narratives.
Yeah.
So one of the main things I was trying to get across was the significance of collections in understanding biodiversity.
Yeah.
How do we decide what species are? How do we classify them? So we used cockatoos because we had a nice range of mounted cockatoos that we could use. We have most of the species represented.
Yeah.
So there's things like that that determine what you actually put up. One of the other things I wanted to touch on was how the collections contribute to our understanding of distribution patterns.
Yeah.
And that can speak to historical, I mean, natural distributions, but it can also speak to changing distributions with climate change or whatever.
Yeah.
One of the things I put in there was a jar of tropical fishes from Sydney Harbour collected in the 1880s.
Yes.
So that speaks to, well, you can't just look at what's there now and say, oh, it's all climate change. You have to look at what was there historically. Mm. Is this a recent thing that tropical fishes are turning up? Probably not. Where they get to further south of is another, a different issue.
Yeah.
And whether there are collections that allow you to understand that is another matter too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the challenge is you want the display to have some aesthetic appeal, but you have narratives that you're trying to address as well. Yeah. So it can be quite challenging coming up with the best way of addressing those two issues.
So given you have curated an exhibition that's about to open, Australian Seashore, could you take us through what that exhibition covers and some of the processes in terms of curatorial selections?
So this is based on a donation of historic photographs. So this is kind of a little outside my curatorial remit and comes under our historian, Jan Brazier's curatorship, the historic photograph collection. It's based on a book produced in 1952 called Australian Seashores.
Yep.
So the donation, the collection donation, the Dakin collection, donated by the Dakin family, we think in around the 1980s,
yes.
It's mostly about the book. They're the actual images, the glass negatives that were used to produce the images in the book.
Yep.
But there's a lot of peripheral images as well.
Yeah, and things also, that didn't make the book.
Yeah, and just things like field photographs that actually give you some insight into the research and the process of producing the book.
Yeah.
There are also various, what tends to be called ephemera, but paraphernalia associated with the book as well, field notes, for instance. There's a painting of one of the research vessels that was used by the Sydney Uni.
Right.
So there's all sorts of interesting things that give you further insight.
Contextualise the recording process.
Yeah. So trying to select material that you want to use, again, images that have aesthetic appeal, but also trying to put them, again, into a narrative that fits. So there's quite a lot of matching images with the book, trying to work out how you can present the essence of the book as well and fit it within other narratives about how the book was produced, and then looking beyond the book to how these photographs might be used in other ways.
Yeah. So, obviously, the object that we're talking about today is one of the images from the book and from the exhibition. Before I talk to you specifically about this image, who was Professor Dakin? Why was his work so significant? Why are we marking this textbook 70 years after its publication?
Well, Professor Dakin was Professor of Zoology at the University of Sydney from 1929 to 1947. He died in 1950, shortly after he retired. So the book
was published after he passed away.
Yeah. Before that, he'd been in various positions in Western Australia and in Europe, and he was trained in Liverpool originally. His research interests are very broad, although mostly to do with marine biology. He worked on everything from physiology of fishes to surveying the plankton off the New South Wales coast, even terrestrial topics. But his main interest, and the interest mostly covered in this book, is the intertidal zone. This is the narrow area on the coast that's exposed between extreme low and high tides.
So mango swamps and
rocky shores, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And trying to understand how different organisms are distributed and why they're distributed in particular ways.
Yeah.
So this developed on from research with his collaborators in the book, Elizabeth Pope, who was an Australian museum scientist. She did her degree, her undergraduate and master's degree at Sydney Uni under Dakin's supervision.
So this is in the 1940s?
1940s, yeah. And that work was mostly based at Long Reef in the northern beaches. They then expanded that study to include the full coastline of New South Wales. Mm. Dakin...
She must have been quite pioneering. I don't imagine there were too many women working in the field of zoology in that particular point.
The other person who was involved is Isabel Bennett, who was originally hired as Dakin's secretary, but went on to become his research assistant and then a pioneering researcher in her own right. She was actually responsible for maintaining the book. So after the book was published in 1952, it went through 40 years of
reprints,
new editions,
and so,
and she kept that up to go.
Oh, wow.
And she also wrote a bunch of other books mostly on marine biology.
Yeah.
She was a pioneer as well. Elizabeth Pope started out as an assistant curator, I think, but eventually became deputy director of the Australian Museum. So both of those women are extremely important, not just in Australian marine science, but worldwide in marine science, as pioneering women in science.
Yeah. Were they recognised during their lifetime, or was it?
Yeah, I think so. Isabel Bennett was given the first honorary master's degree from Sydney Uni, and also an honorary doctorate from New South Wales Uni. She was made an officer of the Order of Australia in 1984.
Yeah.
And certainly Elizabeth Pope was promoted to that position based on her contributions.
Oh,
and
fantastic.
So this is one angle for the exhibition, is the those two figures, and also a third person, Isabel Bennett's friend and colleague, Helen Turner, who at the time had an architecture degree, and she assisted in the field for the fieldwork for the book.
Yeah.
But she went on to become a leading geneticist, particularly in sheep genetics.
So, yes.
So it's kind of...
as far away from the coastline as you can get.
Yeah.
And the textbook itself, I mean, as you mentioned, it went through various editions, but it was obviously a significant impact upon a broader understanding, both from the scientific, but also, I imagine, the popular community about biodiversity within that part of Australia's ecosystem.
Yeah, it was designed for a broader audience. The subtitle of the book, A Guide for the Beach Lover, the Naturalist, the Shore Fisherman, and the Student.
Yeah.
So they tried to cover a lot of ground of interest to anyone that, you know, encourage people to go to the seashore and understand it. If you look back at that period of time, Australians tended to identify as the outback, you know, the red centre.
Yeah,
and we still do to a certain extent.
Yeah, the myth of the bushman and Banjo Paterson and all that.
But Dacom was encouraging, and not only in the book, but also in his ABC radio shows, for people to look towards the coast, that we're actually coastal dwellers.
Mm.
Most of the population is on the coast, but there was a lack of appreciation of the coast. So this was one reason he was pushing the book.
Yeah.
The book is essentially based on the scientific survey they did along the coast, which was published in 1948. So there was the scientific publication.
Yep.
And he decided to turn it into a book.
A popular book.
And the two, effectively co-authors, even though they're identified in the book as assistants, actually saw it through to that that final form after he died.
You're listening to Object Matters. My guest for this particular episode is Dr. Tony Gill, Curator of Natural History at the Chow Chak Wing Museum. So, Tony, Object Matters, we shall get to an object. You have selected one of the photographs that was used in the book, one of the glass negatives, and it is a photograph of a snapping shrimp. So, firstly, could you describe the photograph? And then I'm going to ask a lot of questions about a snapping shrimp.
Right. It's actually two whole snapping shrimps and an isolated claw, the snapping claw from a snapping shrimp. Yeah.
And of course, it's the image has a ruler for scale.
Yep.
And
they're not too big.
They're not too big at all. No, they're not. But I mean, it looks like a shrimp. As a non-expert in any way, shape, or form, it's recognisably a shrimp. This went into the book, in the final book, as one of the images talking about this particular species?
Yeah, well, it went into the book not only as an image, but there was also a line drawing showing detail of the snapping claw. So, like most shrimps, there are two enlarged claws at the front. One is very enlarged, the other one's more kind of normal.
Yep.
The very enlarged one is the one that produces the snapping sound.
So, on that note, well, firstly, what's the scientific name for the snapping shrimp?
Well, there's a family of shrimps called Alpheids. They're worldwide in distribution, mostly tropical to warm temperate in distribution. And you might be familiar with some of the species that associate with gobies. You see these little shrimps living in burrows and gobies live in symbiosis with them.
Right, okay. So in Australia, we're literally getting them, from far north?
All right through.
So even in the south?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. So, snapping shrimp. What's the story? I mean, what a great name to begin with, but the snapping sound obviously has a significant story.
Well, the snapping sound is one of the dominant noises you hear, particularly at night. And so if you've ever tried to sleep on board a yacht or something, you'll hear this snapping all night. And it can be quite loud. It was it was recognised as an important component of the underwater sound quite early on. And during the Second World War, with the development of sonar to detect submarines, often the submarines would go into areas via snapping shrimp colonies, so they'd be masked by the sound
of
the shrimps.
Extraordinary. Wow.
So when the book came out, there was actually quite a lot of attention paid to the snapping shrimp story in the book. So,
did Dakin have a particular interest, do you know, or was it?
I'm not sure if he had a huge interest, but he certainly devoted this illustration and a little story about the sound production.
Yeah.
So what he felt was going on was, as the claw is kind of weirdly shaped, there's a little peg bit on it that sits into a socket. So in the movable part of the claw is where the peg is. And as the claw snaps shut, it pushes into the socket.
Right, okay.
And Dakin correctly described what happens as the jet of water shoots out.
Yeah.
He didn't actually say where the snapping noise came from.
Yeah, right.
But the inference is that it's the claw snapping.
So it's the sound of the claw moving.
The claw actually snapping back into its into its closed position. This topic has been debated a lot through the years. Mm. All sorts of theories have been put out. Aside from the shrimp, the claws whacking together, making the noise, there was also the idea that there was deformation of the exoskeleton, and it's the exoskeleton clicking back into shape was going on.
Yeah.
So, but the essence of it is actually in Dakin. It's the jet of water that's generated. It shoots out at such speed that it creates a bubble, and the bubble expands rapidly, and because of this, the pressure inside the bubble drops extremely low, and it generates huge heat, apparently to the same heat as the surface of the sun. So it's very hot.
You're joking! Wow.
And even produces light.
Yeah.
And so it's only been in recent years that people have discovered what's actually going on using high-speed photography. They've
actually been able
to capture and time it with the sound production. And it's the bubble collapsing that creates the sound.
Wow. So the jet of water and the bubble, that is a protective element?
It's both
element,
used in defense and also in prey capture. So it'll knock things out. It's effectively
creating its own little... Well, throwing dynamite into a dam to kill the fish, isn't it?
Yeah, so it stuns its prey or deters predators.
That's extraordinary.
So,
and the sound's really loud.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard of people in keeping these in aquaria having the glass actually crack from these whacking the side with a with a little jet. So we have an actual QR code to the links to a YouTube video showing the research that showed where the sound production is coming from.
Yep. Excellent. And that includes the sound, I imagine, in the video?
Yep, yep.
Excellent, excellent.
And there's tons of other resources out there. If you look on YouTube, you'll find lots of...
Oh, I know what I'm doing for the rest of the afternoon now.
Yep.
So did Dakin take the photograph himself, or did he have a photographer?
Gwen Burns was the laboratory photographer. So they try to take as many of the photographs in the field as possible.
Yep.
You get a different impression of things when they're in the field than in a lab. But a lot of the things aren't really suited to field photography, particularly smaller organisms. So they brought material back to the Department of Zoology, which was at that time separate from Biological Sciences as a separate entity. And Gwen Burns was the photographer for the department, and she took all of the lab photos.
Fantastic. So it was here on campus. Do you know what year? Do we have any details like that? Or
it would
just
have been
during the production?
It would have been during the production. So I'm assuming in the 1940s, probably 46 to 48, in that kind of general period.
Yep.
Prior to that, Dakin and Bennett were both based in Canberra, working on camouflage to try and camouflage
tanks and other military
and borrowing on Dakin's knowledge of camouflage in the natural world. Interesting, camouflage is actually a military term, so it's gone back and forth. So trying to work out ways to camouflage buildings and vehicles and everything.
Yeah.
But borrowing on examples from nature. So I'm assuming most of this work would have happened post-Second World War.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is one reason for selecting this object and actually having a side story on the object, is it shows we have changing viewpoints progress in understanding the natural world.
Yeah, and a lot of that, of course, is then based upon those generations of observation of the way that the species are interacting with their environment and with other species, I'm assuming.
Yeah, and I think one thing to bear in mind is that there's often, you know, blind alleys. It's not always a straight linear progression. Often people had alternative views that, that don't match.
Yeah. And, well, I guess it's also like everything, isn't it? It's questioning that if sort of the initial natural assumption was that it was the pig, well, we don't need to do any further research. We now know what's causing the noise, whereas quite clearly you do need to keep on coming back and challenging assumptions. And
yeah, and this leads to the reason why it was a particular interest to me, because there was another question generated, which is kind of a little separate to the actual snapping shrimp.
Yeah.
But about 20 years ago, I published a paper with a colleague, Dr. Randy Moy, Canadian ichthyologist, fish scientist. We were trying to work out the classification of this weird little eel-like fish from northern Australia.
Yeah.
And it's got all these weird little modifications, like a straight gut. The jaws can be dislocated. They don't have any gill rakers to impede large prey. And the anal opening is pleated, so it's like a drawstring bag.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But all those characters were also found in another eel-like group of fishes, but we didn't believe those two groups were related.
Yeah, yeah.
In spite of sharing the same characteristics.
Yeah.
What we found was that both actually feed on shrimps.
Ah.
The other family, pretty well any shrimp is up for grabs.
Yeah.
So they could swallow the shrimp whole.
Yeah.
It's unimpeded, and they could excrete the exoskeleton unimpeded.
Yeah.
But what was interesting was the weird little northern Australian one only fed on one sort of shrimp, snapping shrimps.
Snapping shrimps.
So the question is, how do they avoid being blasted
the bang.
by this snap? It could be something as simple as approaching from behind, like a behavioural thing.
Yeah.
But the research hasn't been done yet to really show what's going on. Mm. So there's a question that arises from our better understanding of snapping shrimps, what's going on with the fish.
Extraordinary. So how do you find yourself responding to this particular photograph? Because you would have sent it a lot in recent months in the preparation and then the eventually the installation for the new exhibition. But you know, when you see that image, what goes through your head?
Well, a lot of worrying about how I can present that story concisely without sounding too confusing is the main thing. So, at this stage, it's still pretty fresh as a narrative issue rather than an interest issue.
But it's interesting. It's followed you throughout your career, the snapping shrimp in one way or another.
Yeah.
As you know, there's one question I ask every guest who appears on the podcast. In one word, what does this image signify to you?
Progress.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you were right when you outlined before, just that sense of, isn't it interesting too that, you know, you've had, do you know the very first time that the shrimp was actually identified and first studied?
They've been known for quite a long time. I mean, anything that's so widely, as a family, shrimps are so widely distributed. You can find them in rock pools. You turn over a rock, you're locally going to find snapping shrimps, and they'll immediately start snapping as soon as. So it's not it's not a huge mystery that this is the organism making the noise.
Yeah, but it's taken a long time to get to the point of actually understanding the processes of that noise creation.
And just how remarkable that noise production is.
Yeah, just on that scale of speed and heat. Amazing.
Yeah.
So, final question. What would you like our listeners to think about when they see this image in the exhibition Australian Seashores on level one of the Chowchak Wing Museum?
Well, I'd like them to think about science as a process. We understand something, or we present something as our state of art. This is what we understand at this stage. But it's never written in stone.
Yeah.
There's always additional questions that come up. As a researcher, I find most of my research is about appreciating how little I understand. It's not about, I can file that away as done. There's a whole bunch of new questions.
Well, it's the value of the museums as well, too, isn't it? It's sharing those questions with a much broader public and inviting people to come and ask questions as well.
Yeah, well, that's one thing. Another part of the exhibition actually speaks to citizen science and what people can, or how people can participate in advancing our understanding. We've got a whole bunch of historic photographs, not just in the Dakin collection, but in our historic photograph collection, which gives snapshots of our understanding of the environment at the time.
Yeah.
I'm trying to set up a portal where people can submit contemporary images of the same vistas.
To see the changes.
To look at changes and invite appropriate environmental scientists to look at those images and at least get an initial understanding of what could be going on. I mean, I think there's also a need to go to those places and actually proof what's in the images.
Yes.
But
As a first step,
yeah. And a way of also continuing what has been going on for a very long time, that is the participation of the general public in research. Dakin appreciated that as important. His understanding of distribution of animals in northern New South Wales was advanced quite a lot by an amateur collector up there in Yamba. And a bunch of research he did on prawn biology was in response to a listener on his ABC radio show.
Yes, right.
So there's always been that connection with the public.
Yeah.
And even now, I spend a lot of time actually answering inquiries from the public, particularly identifying fish species in various social media contexts, those things like iNaturalist. Facebook has a number of groups.
Yeah.
So by helping essentially mentor amateur scientists, so that they eventually have the adequate understanding to actually do their own identifications and contribute.
So we can all become mini Dakins ourselves.
Yeah, and I think that there's an essence of that in the book, an invitation for people to go out and look
and
participate. And I think, I mean, no scientist I know of, or no natural history kind of scientist actually spends that much time in the field. Having all these extra eyes out there really is a way of advancing knowledge far faster than they could do independently.
Well, it's a challenge for our listeners. Thank you, Tony. That's a great place to end. It is a remarkable image, it really is, but what an amazing story.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tony.
No worries.
Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chowchak Wing Museum and the University of Sydney pays our respects to the traditional custodians of the lands in which we work.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chowchak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, Muse Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.